Exception number 9185, rule number 3.
Mr. Ken Johnston, reel 3. How would you go about developing an exercise?
Well, for instance, the area of Badenoch, we would perhaps write a piece called The Wolf of Badenoch and bring a romantic piece into it, which would be perhaps a three-day exercise in which certain areas had to be reached, like Derry Lodge, and on from there to a cave, which would be up near Ben Arica or Arachar or one of the mountains, and the trail would lead from one point to another using map references, compass bearings, landmarks where there were any, but wrap it round a tale which had some form of romanticism, and ending with having to find food, which might be at the end of it all, and if you didn't find it, you were unlucky. Then we had an exercise I called Fit to Drop, which was simply that we put them in a lorry, and if the lorry was going at 20 miles an hour, they had to run 20 miles an hour off the back of it to land on their feet holding their rifle, which was what the paratroops did. That was Fit to Drop. And a lot of these exercises are still, of course, the subject of a great deal of hilarity when we have our annual meetings, which go on all the time. And incidentally, this Highland Fieldcraft Training Centre Association, which started after the war, has gone on without any interruption since. And we're meeting in Bath in May, and there will be about 40 or 50 members there, and their sons and their families, probably about 90 of us all.
So you got on well with the cadets, did you all? How did you get on with the cadets?
Oh, tremendous, a tremendous atmosphere. You see, this getting on well with them is something which perhaps Lord Rowallan didn't always appreciate, from my point of view, for instance, because up in Wester Ross, at the end of the course, there was a small pier or jetty ran out at the end of at Pullew, where the lock is, Lockyew it's called, in front of the Pullew Hotel, and I was lured onto that. I was going out for dinner. I had a Sam Brown on, I had my khaki tunic, my hat, and I was lured onto this jetty and suddenly ambushed and thrown into the sea. Of course, my batman was underneath the jetty in a boat with clean clothes and a towel, and I was rescued. Now, this was their way of getting their own back on me. And, of course, I thought that was tremendous, but he was not very pleased about that. There was that relationship. And, of course, I used to have, perhaps it's my own personality, but I had a contact with them which wasn't always perhaps... I cared for them, and there was a very good contact. Sometimes they got a little unruly, sometimes you had to hold them back, but of course under the circumstances one had to appreciate this. And I remember at Newton Moor Station, when the Colonel, Lord Rowallan, as I said, had these two very large moustaches, which were really very large. He said he would never shave them off until the enemy was beaten. One used to go up if he wasn't very pleased, and the other one drooped down. In fact, when he was very displeased, they waggled about like handlebars. But we were standing on the station at Newton Moor, and I'd sort of atoned for one or two rather wild things that may have happened in my company, and things were getting on quite well. And here they were all leaving at the end of the course, and they were waving their hands out of the carriage window, and he turned to me and said, "They're not a bad lot, you know, Ken. Now, I think you had a jolly good crowd there." And suddenly the thunder flashes started coming out of the carriage windows. When these wretched cadets had given us our own back, because we used to use these thunder flashes to simulate noise of grenades and things, and a hail of thunder flashes came down onto Newton Moore Station, and all I could see were these two moustaches going like handlebars, wiggling up and down, and the acrid smell of gunpowder, and the whole of Newton Moore Station in a great cloud, with the colonel desperately stamping off in rage. Well, this is the sort of thing that to me was amusing, but not perhaps to other people.
Would you, you'd come to know them as, you said before, you'd come to know them as individuals.
Yes.
By the end of the 10-week course.
Yes. Which one had, one saw their problems. You saw the one who was over-assertive, the one who was timid. There was one chap there whose father had been a VC and a general. And he was determined to live up to this. But his physique was not very good. He failed the first course, and I might say, I think about 20% were failures, didn't pass, had to go back to their unit. But when he went back to his depot, and they asked him where his unit was, he always at the Highland Fieldcraft Training Centre. So he came back again, and he was there three times. He never did pass. He was always trying to live up to the fact that his father was a general and a VC.
Why would people fail?
Well, they would fail because, first of all, they, on exercises, in given a role, suddenly in command, or having to reach a place, were not able to, if they were in charge of a section of eight, they were told to get somewhere, they really, really messed it all up, not just the map reading, but in their powers of imparting the information to the other people. You see, we had our meetings about them. We had our talks. We had our system of judging. And the system of judging, really, was to... We used to have a system in which we allocated points for various aspects of behaviour, of character, and on improvement. And then we would take the cream and put the cream together. And then we would take the next category and put them together. And then we would take the not yets, as we call them, and put them together. So that during the period of the course, the cadets would find themselves working in different groups. And the cream would work with the cream, as I say, and the next category with the next category, and so forth. So that there was a question of the not yets, or the worst ones, someone would come to the top amongst them and then move up into the next category so that they were moving towards getting amongst the cream again. Or somebody amongst the cream might falter and slip back. So that the system was to bring like with like, so that out of it emerged a leader amongst the like.
Would the cadets know this was going on? Would they know if they were in the cream group? Or?
Yes, yes. In point of fact, to jump right into the modern time now and explain to you that, of course, this has now been adopted at Sandhurst, and there is a Rowallan company there. When I visited them, I found that in the Rowallan Company, which was moving along the lines of what we did at the Highland Fieldcraft Training Centre, they moved them literally, physically, from one barrack room to another every week. So people were picking up their kit and moving into a barrack room amongst other people regularly throughout the time they were together. They were physically moving into areas where they were more or less the best the elite. Well, now, we didn't make them pick the kit up and move. They worked together as groups according to their rating. And you see, the point here was that we watched how the interaction of character against character, where some people could work with other people, where some people were overcome by other people, and how they dealt with it. The clash of personalities, all this was a very, very interesting study. But behind it all, what one really wanted to get was somebody who could lead, who could take care of his men, who could really appreciate his basic training, but express it with some form of intelligence, reliability, and to have what a word I used to use, a responsibleness to think for themselves.
Did you treat the successes in any way differently from the way you treated the not yets or the failures?
Well, of course, the end of all this was the War Office Selection Board, who came up and examined them. And what they did in their testing and the results they got were not always what we thought. We had a very high degree of passes, 75 or 80%, I think. Don't forget, these were people who'd already been failed. We were reclaiming. And over the period of the Highland Fieldcraft Centre, over 1,000 officers were reclaimed from having been rejected or not passed by War Office Selection Board. One of these chaps became a general officer commanding the Malayan Army. He was a Malaysian. He didn't pass. The first was B. He came up to us. And he ended up as a general officer commanding the army of his country. Don't forget, too, we had amongst us a VC. Well, he wasn't there as a cadet, he was there as an instructor, a chap called Jake Annand from my own regiment, who was famous as the Wheelbarrow VC, the DLI. Then, from the later years, these chaps have taken up all sorts of positions in industry. A chairman of a bank, one of them.
Would you work, though, if someone wasn't doing very well, would you work more with him than with the cream? In other words, would you give more attention to the people who are faltering?
Yes, very much. And this was where sometimes it was possible and sometimes it wasn't. I remember one young guardsman whose father was the governor of a section of the British Commonwealth, who felt that by right, because of his name and being in the Guards, he should have a commission. But, I mean, he was somebody who it was impossible to pass him in the end because of arrogance, because of attitude, and because of not doing what the DS wanted. We were called the DS, the directing staff.
Would you fail someone purely because they were, or would someone get bad grades purely because he was unable to meet the physical demands of the course?
Well, I think the physical demands, I mean, providing one got round, it was a great feather in anybody's cap to be not so strong physically and to do it, obviously. And that counted enormously for them compared with some great robust countrymen, like an ox who could go anywhere and do this sort of thing. And they didn't always impress you as much as the guy who had obviously overcome all sorts of difficulties. It may be, of course, he wouldn't have been in the army at all if he'd had bad asthma or so forth. But there were defects people had, and they overcame them.
So, was it possible for someone to meet the physical demands as long as they were basically fit, which is what, of course, there should be in the army?
Yes.
So there was nothing that demanded great strength or great tolerance of cold or such like?
Not really. You didn't have to be any Herculean sort of attributes, but it was the determination, you see, that one of the great things was determination. I mean, we had a And neither was it anything to do with education, because we had a rough sort of guy who could be able to do what was required of him, who was responsible, you know, and had the drive. He would get it, as far as we're concerned. But the chap who thought he knew everything and was difficult to convey to would have no more chance better than the other, even if they may have had a much better education.
Would you yourself go along, if they were sent on an exercise, you know, like this one you described,
yes,
would you go along with them, or would you observe them from afar, or would you just rely on their own internal reports to find out what happened?
No, we very often went along with them, sort of with white armbands on, as though we're here, but we're not here, if you know what I mean. Sometimes we would meet them en route and observe them, that was, going with them was a lot of it too, because one heard the reactions. It didn't matter how badly they swore, of course, but you heard the reactions, the one who whimpered and groaned and grumbled, and the people who enthused others. And of course you also saw the one who was enthusing others to try and impress you. There's a lot of that in life, what we call the bullshitters, of which the army, of course, had its share. And all these things you could watch as a sort of... It was like a kind of benevolent democracy, really. I mean, as I say, or rather say benevolent dictatorship, what one really wanted to do was to be a voyeur, in many ways, to see how they reacted. And, of course, they were put into positions of sudden emergencies, deliberately, to see how they would react.
What sort of sudden emergency would you conjure up, then?
Well, they've been marching all day, and they're just sitting down to have their tea. They're making their tea behind the proper folds in the ground, and then you kick all the billies over and say there's an air raid. And, of course, those were emergencies that didn't go down awfully well, but they're the sort of things one did for them. Took the food and threw it in the sea, in the river, and said, there's been an attack, you can't have it. Put them under moments of great stress like that, which are not very pleasant to experience, but they do happen in actuality.
What if you did something like that, throw someone's food in when they're hungry? Would there ever be any... would they ever make a move to taking some action against you?
Well, I think that they would. They would tend to, yes. We never really did. We were never attacked like that I know of. But it wasn't done in a ruthless way like that, without a reason. That there was behind it these sort of noises of attack, as though you had been attacked, and that there was a reason for it.
This is when you'd use the thunder flashes and
the thunder flashes and all sorts of perhaps little counter raids by some of the DS.
Of the who?
The directing staff, perhaps at night time, attacking an area where they were. They got awfully tired. They got very exhausted in the mountains, and then there was the dangers of the weather, the blizzards, the fog. One hears in the press about accidents under normal conditions quite often in these mountains, and they were subjected to all those problems. They knew how to get bodies on the Robinson stretchers down the hillsides. They were taught rock climbing and abseiling. And we gave them instruction about mountain craft. We had specialists. There was one man, I remember, Murray Levick, right at the beginning of these courses, who gave the most marvellous lectures on how to feed off the land, how to live off berries and that sort of thing. So they were given a lot of instruction on how to take care of themselves. As I say, they came out of that course like lions. And in later life, as one has met them, they've become directors of companies and done things, they have taken one aside and said, my ambition really started at the Highland Fieldcraft. That's when I realised that I really could do something in life. And it took them through the rest of the war. Because don't forget, I mean, when one saw these chaps arriving, they were just callow 18 and 19-year-olds. Some of them had never been away from home. And there was a war on, and they were suddenly faced with a rejection they hadn't passed. They'd been told they were not yet suitable for a commission, which was a blow to their pride in many cases. And then there was this chance up in this wild country with these strange people with toggle ropes round their waist and corduroy trousers and a look of zeal and enthusiasm, and this young man who was really, I wasn't much older than they were, who was a major, rushing round them. Sometimes I think people thought I was quite mad, you know, but I mean, it's just that sort of feeling that raised spirits, that made them realise they were under difficult, but dangerous a little bit, but different circumstances. Their whole dimension of life changed, that it took them out of their environment, and that's what is needed so much with leadership training, that people should push away the sort of ordinary environment. Well, I would have loved to have seen something like this happening as a form of national service. I would have loved to have seen shiploads of young people going to Canada or going up into Scotland, and I would love to see unemployed gathered in such camps where they could enjoy themselves and learn fieldcraft and be trained in their character. And I'm quite sure there would be less crime and less hooliganism if that was so. In fact, it is pretty sure in my mind that the outward bound training developed on this later. And of course Kurt Hahn at Gordonston, many of the teachings that he had were embodied in this sort of attitude that we had.
Did you have any such... I don't think you would have done from what you say, but did you have any sort of daily routine for either you or the cadets while you were there?
Yes, of course we had our... the parades and weapon inspection and a lot of physical training exercises. So we would have the day divided into its program very clearly. Period of, our tuition. Yes, that happened. We had discussions. We had a great deal of open-end discussions. We had a great deal of people trying to express themselves and being aided to express themselves.
How did the local population of the area react to you running around throwing thunder flashes removing police cars and that sort of thing?
Well, I think there were one or two little irate letters came at one time or another, particularly when we were over on the West Coast in an exercise and the LDV were on the point, and some lieutenant who had been ordered around suddenly got a bit excited and annoyed because he then explained he had been the CNC of India or somewhere and he was only doing this although he was very well past retiring age. But generally speaking, people realised that we were helping the good of the whole place. Don't forget, it was a prohibited area, as I said, north of Achnasheen. When the train came in at Achnasheen, and these guys used to come off, and people felt sorry for them in the district, I think, because there were all sorts of blood-curdling tales got about of what really did happen. And they go on now. When we go back for our... Every 3 years we go back and many of us meet. And we meet every year, as I've said earlier, in some part of the country. There's about 300 of us. Don't forget, we were not in any particular units. We were from all sorts of units. We went off into all sorts of units. We went off into all sorts of theatres of war. And yet we have kept together because the spirit is there, and it has been maintained over all these years, so that we meet, we have an annual general meeting, and a dinner in the, nowadays in the Air Force Club in London. There's about 38 or 40 go every year.
Is it the passes or the failures? Do any of the failures come?
It's never discussed. The failures are there just as much. And incidentally, every year somebody new turns up. Someone who has just heard about it, or someone who's always meant to come. And we have, as I say, over 300 in the association now.
How did you come to leave the trains?
I think Lord Rowallan got a bit fed up with me, really. I suppose I was getting, as I say, a little bit bloody-minded, perhaps. I wanted the exercises to be stronger and stronger. Perhaps I'd had enough. I had been there over five or six courses, And so I went from there. My unit was in Norfolk.
Did you regret leaving? Or?
Yes, I did regret leaving at the time. I think one always does when you've helped to create something. I mean, a lot of the programs I devised, one does regret it. It happens. Of course, the army is a great place for abrupt arrivals and departures. It's like a sort of vast railway station. And I'd had a good time there. It had got difficult later because, of course, the conditions were not easy. But I went to London. My unit was in Thetford in Norfolk. I'd lost touch with them a little bit, and they were there and have stayed on there for a long time before they went over to Holland. And so I got involved with yet again another training episode, and this time I remember I had to go to a big transit place in London, and my mother came down from Newcastle, and we sat in the park, in the Green Park. I know exactly the spot where she sat, and she was down 2 days, and I said, I'll go and see if my name is on the board each day. And the second time I came back and it was on the board, I told her we were leaving, and I understood it was West Africa for training. And we had a meal in the Northern Hotel in near King's Cross, and there was a man called Westwood there, who was later Lord Westwood, in charge of the Admiralty, Labour at the Admiralty. And I said cheerio to him, and I said to my mother, I'll meet you back here. And it was 3 years later before we met there again. I went to West Africa, and once again I was on training, school of training, in the jungle warfare training. I remember we had a great big pipe in the ground, and I used to put these people crawling through here and then push a chicken through the other end so that the person crawling and the chicken met. And well, that was another thing. Perhaps one was getting a bit tougher again with the training. But
who was being trained there? Was it British troops or West African?
They were both, really, mostly West African, and they were to go to Burma.
What experience had you had in jungle? I mean, you obviously hadn't had practical experience, but did you have to go on a course first?
No, I really had to teach myself in the light bush in West Africa, which was, of course, nothing like the jungle. But again, it was really the sort of basic, what I had learned before and applying it again. I tried very hard then to get into action, and I sent telegrams to, I remember, this Lord Westwood at the Admiralty. I sent telegrams to people in my regiment, and Admiral Lord Keyes, I remember, for some reason, sending him everywhere. I was sending, get me into action. And one reached a chap in Burma called Brigadier Jeffries with the Durham Light Infantry, and he said he would have me. And I was put on a plane, but I was taken off the plane because they discovered I wasn't a colonel, and they weren't going to fly anybody direct to the theatre of war unless they were at least a colonel. So I was put on a boat called the Almanzora, and we eventually got to India, and I joined the West Africans, went down the Arakan with the 81st Division and then the 82nd Division.
Did you find the reality of being on active service, did it match up with the sort of things you'd been teaching and been taught?
Well, of course, that is a very, very good question. And the army did have many sort of paper soldiers and paper tigers and so forth. There is no doubt that the basic field craft, the basic idea of self-protection and camouflage and down and crawl, observe and fire, all this basic training is there. You can't miss it. It's there.